And it may not need to be three. In fact, what I finally learned is that three was a waste of time. So now I just, you have one sentence. What's the one reason that you are the only firm that I can work with? Honestly, the answer I get a lot of times is, we'll get back to you. Because that's really what it comes down to. What is the one thing that you do that they can't get anywhere else?
Exactly. Everybody better operate that way if they're going to be any success in that business. Yeah. Right? It's not a unique differentiator.
Having integrity in financial services is kind of like having food in the restaurant industry. It's more of a prerequisite than a key.
It's exactly it.
Welcome back, John. Thanks for doing this again with me. I know I was just kind of telling you we're going to kind of figure out what the show's about as we go along. But I really enjoyed our conversation last week. And it was one of these things that I felt like we were just kind of getting warmed up when we ran out of time, or I ran out of battery, I believe was actually the case there. But we had just kind of started to talk a little bit about learning what your vision is as a business. And we had just kind of started to scratch the surface on, okay, once you know what your vision is, if you just put that on bumper stickers or slogans or websites or whatever, and then you go and execute a completely different business plan, you're not going to be successful at all. And you're going to get a reputation of being phony or a poser or, you know, whatever you want to, you know, insert whatever word you want to use here, but none of them are good for from the public's perspective.
Great.
So it's, I think that's such an important piece of running a business. And I think you're right. I think that's worthy of its own show topic. So second episode in, we're already off script of our perfect little 13, you know, list of 13 topics. We've already gone off script on the second one.
I don't think we'll ever get to the 13. We'll be at show 100 going, remember what number 9 was? Oh yeah. There was a number 9. It's like a long time ago. And that's the nature of, that's actually the nature of the work that I do. It's the nature of being in business. It's like, you know, we always joked in the planning world, and I'm sure you remember this, is like the second a plan is written, it's obsolete, right? And which is why most of us don't really write plans anymore, because the temptation is to say, oh, perfect. I now know where I'm going. I now know what I am. I now know what I'm doing. And something comes along and that's out the window. Which is why we were talking before even the importance of having that framework, right? It's really more important to have a framework around which decisions can be made as opposed to having a plan about that already has made the decisions, because you just don't know what the variables are going to be and what decisions have to be made even a week from now, much less 3 months from now or 3 years from now.
I think it was Mike Tyson. I don't want to give credit to the wrong person, but I'm pretty sure it was Mike Tyson that said everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, because everybody that fought him said they had a plan to beat him, and he said everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. But I think that's definitely the nature of business, and I think it's important as a business owner to know the direction that you're taking your business. I give the analogy sometimes, you know, I'm in North Carolina, you're in California. This is a beautiful analogy. There are 100 different ways I can get from California to get to California from here if I wanted to drive. I can go through the north, through the Midwest, through the south. There's hundreds of different interstate combinations. I don't necessarily have to leave North Carolina knowing exactly which exit I'm going to take at exactly what time and exactly where I'm going to stop and fill up for gas and every little detail of it. But I better know to head west. You know, that it's generally going to be going that way. If it's morning when I leave, then I need to be driving away from the sun. Or if it's afternoon, I need to be driving towards it. That's a pretty good little check mark that I better make sure I know.
Yeah.
But other than that, you have to maintain some flexibility, because your best plan may get derailed in Tennessee.
Well, you have to go north for a little while because of something, right? And having the framework around which you can make those decisions is the thing I think it's missing for a lot of businesses that are trying to get going. And again, you're so deep in the weeds, you can only really pay attention to what's right in front of you. And you may keep driving west into whatever that problem was, because you said, going west, so that's what I'm going to do, right? It's very important to have the ability to pivot, make adjustments, what I affectionately refer to as bob and weave, to stay in the Mike Tyson analogy, right? But you got to be able to bob and weave through life, because that is thinking that you're not going to ever run into an obstacle is really just not going to happen. Sorry.
I want to be careful with the way I word this, but I may not quite word this the right way, but I would say it's important as a business owner, when you're really at every step along the way, from the day you make the decision to start a business to every part of your day-to-day life running the business, to probably not just accept, but also come to expect failure. There are going to be things that you had in your plan. Failure, that's what I say. Failure may not be the right word there. It's not, we're not accepting that the business is failing. But you're going to have plans that do not go the way you thought they were going to go. Great example is I had a, as I've been kind of building mine out, I've known that there was a second layer to this cake that I needed to build out a little bit. And the light bulb went off one day and I knew I had the perfect idea, perfect way to fill in this gap that I had in my business and expand my services. And I think I sent out a batch of about 10,000 emails, and it was by far the lowest click rate or engagement rate I'd gotten on anything. And then of 100 and some people who got to my landing page, there are more people on this recording right now than there were that ever clicked a button to go on to learn more about it. Okay. And I thought that was a great plan. It was wrong. You know, Now I can bang my head against a concrete wall for a month and try to figure out how to change this and make everybody like this thing that I thought was so great. Or I can accept that I was wrong and I can move on to the next, you know, whatever's next in my path. I think that's something that being adaptable in that is sometimes can be the difference in successful businesses and very quick failures.
Yeah. Rigidity is the enemy of pretty much any entrepreneurial endeavor because there's too many variables you just don't know for sure. And you know, it's even going back to a couple of minutes ago when we were talking, and I had this thought. It's like you put it out there, and you know, even if you don't use the word, you know, opposer or imposter, but if you put out a message and it's not resonating with your actions, right? If you're saying one thing but your actions are something different, what will happen is you may not get called anything negative. But you won't get anything positive that you're looking for either, right? Mm-hmm. That you won't attract clients. The magic of attracting clients or customers and growing and spontaneous growth is this knowing who you are, articulating who you are, what you stand for people to hear, having that resonate with people and they go, that's what I want. And then they are attracted to you and then they go to you. Right. There's so many pieces to that. So then if they get to you and you're not doing what they expected you to do, they'll disengage almost instantly. You can attract a lot of people, but if they don't get past, you know, the first 30 seconds on your website or the, you know, the first 5 seconds of your video, then you lost that chance. You're never going to get it back again. They see your face again. They're going to go, but that it didn't resonate. And they're just going to forget about you.
Yeah. What are some checkpoints in what are some things that you do day in and day out to make sure that you're staying aligned with what your vision is? That I mean, and we've got some specific ones with your branding. I mean, view from above being the whole meaning behind Altus and the name of your firm. How do you check your own temperature throughout your daily, weekly, monthly life to make sure that you're executing that? Because I guess for me, I mean, if you're looking at view from above and you're bogging your clients down in details, that's probably going a little bit against what your branding is, right? But at the same time, you're here to help them execute those details, but with that bigger picture. So I guess, how do you make sure that you're, what are your litmus tests?
Well, I do try on a daily basis just to approach the who am I question and just make sure it's like, all right, I'm starting my day. Am I ready to be no place else? Am I ready to be the person that I said I was going to be today? And even then you can do it. You can do it once a day. I like to do that. It's part of my morning ritual. It's just to refresh my memory. I've got a little sticky note here on this computer over the side that just basically says, you know, view from above and provide perspective, right? Are we doing that? And even then, no matter how many times you remind yourself, you can slip off the cliff and it's just a process, right? You try, you do your best. You do the exercise and you go back and you review and you say, well, did I really do that? I tend to especially bring that back up in my own mind when something happens that it was like, wait a minute, that client left me. That client decided that they said, well, we can no longer afford it or whatever. Or they get to 3 months down the line, they say, I just don't have time for this. Or something happens in their lives and they say, I need to put a pause on this because I have to go address this other thing. It's like, well, we must have done something along the lines to set that up because stuff always happens. And but you're responding to that stuff happening in a way that is not what we're talking about we should be doing. So that's when I start to really kind of re-examine, what did I do here? What did I do here to contribute to that falling off the rails as much as possible?
So there's that, but then I think that's a good example too of what we're kind of talking about in that evolution of your mission and your vision to start with. Because yes, there's two sides of that coin, or two possibilities for what is going on there, right? There could be a situation that at the core of the matter, your client was dissatisfied with your service for some reason or another. Your professionalism, the execution of something, they didn't like your advice. There's different ways that different causes of that. And they just don't want to be rude to you. They're trying to be nice. Humans sometimes, not always, have a tendency to try to avoid conflict, and they don't want to tell you you did something wrong, so they'll try to figure out a way to smooth it over. There's also a possibility that they're being genuine, and that they really do have, they like you, they like your service, they want to be able to use your service. Something came up and they can't afford it, or they don't have time for it, or there's something that was not on the schedule 3 weeks ago, 3 months ago when they engaged with you.
Absolutely.
But that also presents an opportunity for you to look at your own business and say, okay, this is a new hurdle that maybe I hadn't solved for. This is something that there are multiple reasons why a client could potentially say no at the beginning of an engagement to choose not to use me, or at the end of engagement to choose to fire me. Or in that case, maybe it's laying you off instead of firing you, might be a better way of even using the analogy there. So what can I do, should I do to my business to be more accommodative to this situation in the future?
Absolutely.
And is that going to compromise my core values as a business? Because if the answer is yes, then I can't make that change, right? Example of this, I had someone talk to last week who's interested in engaging me with for a recruiting service. They're a really, really intriguing opportunity. I'd love to work with them. I think there's a lot of good opportunities for us to work together. They wanted to make some tweaks to the way I do pricing, or they seem to be suggesting maybe some tweaks to the way I price, not necessarily to ask me to accept less, just realigning the way it was done. And for the most part, I think that's a very fair and reasonable thing to do with this, and I want to do it. However, there's a tiny little bit of a way that it could somewhat compromise that branding of, okay, I'm advisor serving, not firm serving. Now, it's not an extreme thing, and it's a very subtle thing, and it's I've got to make that decision. I haven't made it yet, and we'll continue to have conversations about it. But that's one of those things where you have to decide, do I bend a little bit here? Because having the opportunity to work with someone that would be a good partnership and a good opportunity, sometimes you need to bend a little bit, but you can't break your core values. And you always have to know where that line is and how to be adaptable without compromising.
And that really goes back to the whole concept of what I call framework, right? So it's a means by which you can look, you can make a decision, and you have a process, a way of looking at all the variables associated with that decision and putting this one higher than this one or like that, right? And I think the framework should be values-based and culture-based, that in general, this one is always higher than this one. And am I willing to make an exception? Sure, maybe I can make an exception if I feel like this one isn't really, you know, it's not a major exception to this value, or I'll do this as a one-off. What I have learned in my many years of doing this is every time I start doing something like that, 6 months, 9 months later, a year later, it's like, I should have stuck with what I really thought, right? I compromised my values. I didn't think I was really compromising much of anything. And it's come back and I've shot myself in the foot in the long run. Or it just didn't work out the way I'd hoped it might. And that's part of the ongoing decision-making process too, is looking at that framework and say, did it serve me well? Did when I made the decision, was that decision-making process, did it work for me? Or maybe could I improve my framework? And you can always build better scaffolding around which to make your decisions in the future.
Yeah, I think the word that I think about a lot there is evolution. I mean, it's a process. I mean, I think I used the AT&T analogy before. If AT&T had dug their heels in at some point in time and said, we are only a telephone lines company, like we only do things with telephone lines, this mobile stuff and this web stuff, we are not getting into this generation. They're out of business. There is nothing left for them to be at this point if they go that route. they had to make the decision at some point that we're going to embrace something new. We're going to bend a little bit. We're going to adapt. And that was the correct decision. I could probably, well, I would say I could probably find you a lot of examples of folks making the wrong decision in that. But honestly, I can't because they're not in business anymore. So I don't know. You don't find those. The graveyards are full of the skeletons of those businesses that chose the wrong path. But you have to accept that evolution of your business and embrace that evolution of your business. And even your core values may evolve slightly over time as you find out that, you know, you can be really rigid about a certain core value that your clients just don't care about. For whatever reason, they could care less that you are you have this great core value that you think is very important. And if the other people that you're engaging with in your services with don't think that's important, or they don't share your level of enthusiasm about that value, okay, maybe that one is one that you can compromise. But when it comes to integrity and sincerity and the ones that, you know, whatever it is in our industry and financial services, I mean, I hate to say it because integrity is one of those things everyone claims to have it, whether they do or not. You have to have on your website that you have integrity, because if you don't, I don't know, you fall behind somehow. But when everybody puts it out there, you know, does it really matter anymore? Now you're just saying because you have to say it. But you have to act with integrity, whether it's on your website or not. The first time you are not acting with integrity, that's going to do more damage to your business than anything else you can imagine.
Sure.
So you can't bend on those, but you have to be able to adapt to technology. You have to be able to adapt in the way you service your clients. So it's understanding that, and this is not a science, right? Like, we can't sit here and put on the screen a bullet point checklist of do this, don't do this, don't do this. It's really just about accepting and embracing the art of the business, really, and understanding that there's that balance.
So if you were, you know, kind of following along that analogy, if you were a person who said, who always met people in their office, never met people virtually, right? This is just who you are. And if your clients are the ones that really, really want that, and they don't want ever to change, and they always want to come into your office, and they always want to pay for parking, and they always want to deal with the hassles. If that's who you've attracted, and you stick with that, those people will stick with you. Now, will you attract new ones? And that's part of the question. Your business is always going to have some attrition. But you may also find that those people aren't always going to feel that way. A COVID will come along and they go, you know what, I realize I don't really like wasting an hour and a half driving to an appointment and get, you know, doing the parking and all that. That's a 30-minute or 45-minute appointment or even an hour appointment. I don't like doing that. It wastes a lot of my time. I would rather not have to go into town. I'd rather do this electronically. Even people who always enjoyed the in-person thing, and they said they always enjoyed the in-person thing, right? That's that evolution. And I think it is important to ask yourself always, are these values still important? Are they still important to my clientele? Is the way I'm doing whatever I'm doing, is that still high on the priority? And I'm not saying jesting that people send out surveys, because I'm so sick of tell us how you did or tell us how we're doing surveys. It's like, please don't waste my time anymore. It's deleted. It's like, if you have to bribe me with a $20 coupon to do a survey, I'm definitely not doing it. Yeah. It's like, if I want to tell you people I like you, I will tell people I like you. If I like something you're doing, if I really like something you're doing, I will tell you. Otherwise, don't ask me for that. But that's a sidebar.
The survey thing is so interesting to me, because I think they are the biggest waste of time, even for the businesses side, because there are only two types of people that fill out those surveys. Those who are really, really mad about the service, or those who are really, really happy about the service. So you're getting a hot, cold mix. There is no actual, you never really get somebody who just had a mediocre experience that decides they want to fill out a survey.
Yeah, and you're not going to get any actionable feedback, right? All you're going to get is a number. And I guess you get a sense if the number is going up or down, right? So you get, it's you're on a scale of 1 to 5, and you've been averaging a 4.4, and now you're averaging a 4.3. But even that is suspect data. And that, by the way, is another stuff.
Because that's giving you the impression that your average is getting better, when really what's changing is your success rate, because it's a binary proposition when you frame it that way, right? Your the surveys are not presented in a binary way. they're saying 1 to 5 so that someone theoretically can put a 2, a 3, a 4. But in reality, people are only going to fill it out when they're really happy and are going to give you a 5, or really upset and they're going to give you a 1. So all your average star rating ends up being is what percentage of really big wins did you have versus really big losses.
And which percentage of those, if you have a whole bunch that are mad at you, they're mad enough to actually do the survey, because the real binary part about that is how many of the people who are sent the survey actually do the survey.
Right.
And if you start living life on the polar, because you have a lot, that would be the thing to pay attention to, is like all of a sudden my survey success rate is going up. That might not be such a... Going back to all of this is the idea of culture, the idea of values, and it isn't just, yes, so some values are just integrity, you know, consistency, whatever you want. They are, you can say that they're your values and you can put it out there. You're definitely drawing attention to that. And if everybody's saying integrity is a value and you see it on, you know, more than 5% of the people in your business, then it's not really a marketable value. Right.
Good example of that. So I do advisor recruiting. So helping advisors when they're changing firms, look at the different firms that are out there and which one's best for their practice. And this is the one thing out of all my, you know, wild couple of years here, this is the one thing I keep circling back to that I'm actually good at. So I just keep doing that because it's, you know, that needs to be where I need to be. But I used to ask the question to firms when a firm comes to me and wants me to recruit for them, I'll ask them, okay, talk to me like I'm an advisor. Tell me why I should choose your firm. They all have the exact same three answers. Okay. Competitive payouts, you know, a good culture, leadership culture, and industry-leading tech stack. If every single firm that I talk to is telling me the exact same three things, then that means that none of those three things are actually key differentiators. They are literally the definition. They are literally the opposite of a definition of a key differentiator. Two things about that. Number one, half the time the firms that are saying this don't realize that those three things aren't their unique value propositions. They're siloed in their own bubble. They really do think they have the best payouts, the best culture, and the best technology, where they just don't realize there's 100 firms just like them saying the same thing. So that's where a SWOT analysis kind of comes in. And even though that's like business school 101, that's something I think as you progress in business, sometimes you can forget to do your own SWOT analysis occasionally and really assess where you are in the landscape. Because if you're not doing that, what you start to do is just become very stale and you start to say the same things everybody else is saying, not realizing that everybody else is saying it. But you have to know what you need to make your key differentiators actually key differentiators and make sure that and it may not need to be three. In fact, what I finally learned is that three was a waste of time. So now I just go to one question. You have one sentence. What's the one reason that you are the only firm that I can work with? And that usually, honestly, the answer I get a lot of times is, we'll get back to you. You know? And I think that's a fair answer. That means I'm asking the right question, I think, because that's really what it comes down to. What is the one thing that you do that they can't get anywhere else?
Exactly. Exactly. And so when we were talking last time about the marketing message makeover and a lot of the work that I do with clients about, you know, why is that so important? Is because one, we're trying to get rid of the three things. There was this, in personal development, there's this kind of concept or rule, and I'm not sure if it was, I know it's been quoted by lots of people, and I just don't know who originated the concept. But if you try to do one thing, just one thing, and do it really, really, really well, even if it's a Herculean task that you are, you know, aspirational, but you just try to do that one thing, you try to hit that one concept, and you put all your effort into that one concept, the chances of you actually succeeding with that, pretty high, like 80%. Yes, there's still going to be potential failure, even aspirational. Again, I'm talking like through the moon stuff, like Tesla-oriented kind of things, right? One thing. You try to do two things at the same time, the chances of either of them happening drop, the percentage chance drops to about 10%.
Yeah.
You go for three things at once, which is what everybody wants to try to do with their business. I want to do these three things. It's like the chances that you're going to have any success, pretty close to zero.
Yeah. It's an exponential drop off there. I mean, and I get what you're saying there with, it's not about the degree of difficulty, right? Mm-hmm. And take away from business for a second. If I say that I want to climb Mount Everest, that's a very simple individual goal. Pass or fail, do I get to the top or do I not? And I know exactly what I need to do. But it's hard. Yeah, it may kill me, but it's not complicated to figure out what does that entail? It entails going to Mount Everest and climbing to the top of it. It's just really hard. You're not going to get more business by creating a more complicated business model, right? Yep. The most successful businesses are always very simple. You know what they do, right? You know what Walmart does. You know what AT&T does. You know what Apple does, what Google does. I mean, you know what these companies do without even having to see their commercials. You know what I mean? And I also think it's – and I wanted to just kind of touch on this a little bit if we have a couple minutes here. I've learned it's really important. Like, I know this is important, but I've really gotten to see recently how important it is to test things in small doses first and grow into that, right? I mean, I used to come up with ideas, and when I say used to, 3 months ago, I'm just now learning. But you come up with these ideas, and you work as hard as you can, as quick as you can to get them implemented, and then you tell as many people as you can about them right away. And that is a really dangerous thing if your idea stinks, right?
Yeah. Well, you
just companies use focus groups, things like that. You have to come up with an idea, roll it out, small little test, a big enough test that the data is relevant, but not so big that it's going to wreck your business if your hypothesis is wrong.
Yeah, well, you can also scale up the test, right? As an entrepreneur, we're all really good at coming up with ideas. And just like the one you were telling about earlier, it's like, and I was absolutely certain that's the brand new mousetrap. That is the thing that's going to change the world, right? I've had lots of those. I still have several of them rattling around up there.
Yeah.
Things I'd like to do someday because I know that it will change the world potentially, right? Mm-hmm. But I tend to start with people who are close to me. I have a couple of friends, my wife, right? And to say, here's my idea. And if the result that I see on their face is like, huh? Then it's like, okay, either I'm not articulating it correctly, possible, certainly in the realm of possibilities, or it's really not as brilliant an idea as I thought it was at 2:30 this morning when I thought it up, right? And just being willing to say, go back to the whole Thomas Edison thing, right? Thomas Edison, some people say he failed 10,000 times, and he said, no, I just found 10,000 ways that don't work for inventing the light bulb, right?
Yeah.
I think the willingness of somebody to be humble enough to think that their brilliant idea may not be brilliant, but see, what happens is like, you throw that out to 3, 4, 5 people, and you constantly get the, I wouldn't even bother scaling it up and saying, well, let's do a little bit more. Let's flesh it out a little bit more, maybe get to the point of doing a more constructive focus group type thing. You just, but now if you do that and you throw it out to a few people and they all go, that sounds interesting. I've really always kind of been curious about that. All right, now we're going to put more energy behind this, and let's see where that idea goes. And then, yes, go to the maybe potentially not even a true full-on focus group, but a mini focus group, right? You get 20 people in a room, and you say, look, I'm just thinking about this. This is what I'm, you know, have a dinner, have friends over for a barbecue, and just you float this is the whole purpose of this is we're going to float this one idea. I just want honest feedback. And if you get a bunch of screwy looks on the faces of those 20 people and you don't get anybody that says, that seems interesting, all right.
Yeah.
We had a good dinner.
And I've experienced both of those, I think. I think I've had ideas, but see, this is where it's really hard to know if this is humility or not. Sometimes you have got really good ideas that you just can't figure out how to articulate. You know, and I think that's the entrepreneur's trap, right? Because we all think we're so brilliant. We're not, but we think we are. So we think that our idea is brilliant. We're just too smart to figure out how to communicate it to normal people, right? It's like the worst example of horrible pride that you're ever going to see, and it kills us. But a lot of times you just think that we're just not communicating it right. And you can get stuck in the mud trying to beat that dead horse to death until you finally figure out how to get it to click, when in reality it's never going to click because it's actually not that great of an idea. Yeah. And then I've had some ideas that were just terrible, and like 5 minutes later you realize how terrible the ideas were. But I think that is probably a more common thing than just, you know, you and I face that. I think that's a major trap of entrepreneurs is that we do have so many ideas that a lot of them aren't very good. We don't accept that quick enough.
Well, that's fine. And I think if you hit the articulation wall, that's what I call it, when you're trying to, you have this thing that you know you want to share, and you every time you share it, people look at you screwy. It's like maybe it's your wording or maybe what you're sharing is garbage, and you don't know that what's – which one is it? Yeah. I don't know.
And it doesn't matter, right? If they don't buy, it doesn't matter why they didn't buy.
Why they didn't buy. Business, right?
Your bank account doesn't care if the, you know, why they didn't buy. They just care that they didn't buy. So,
and part of it is, I think if you hit the articulation wall, you can just say to yourself one of two things. You can say it's a crappy idea, or you can say it may be a good idea. I can't articulate it now. I would just say, let's move on. Keep thinking of other ideas. Put it on, maybe write it down on a piece of paper, put it in the waiting room or whatever, right? And go back and revisit it in 3 months, and maybe you'll go, oh, that still really feels like a good idea. Maybe I do need to continue to work on the articulation. You can work on it and try it again. It's like, obviously it didn't work well the way I expressed it last time. I don't even remember how I expressed it last time. Let me see if I can articulate it differently and try it again. That's fine too.
I think that's a great closing tip, I think, there is to write these ideas down somewhere and to have that think tank somewhere sitting around. Whether that's – I mean, I've got them in a few places. I've got a literal physical notebook that I kind of carry. It's not in reach right this second, but I can promise you it's in the room, right? Like, it's never out of the – it's never out of my reach. When I travel, it usually goes in the bag with me because I just – if I need something, I'll do it. I've got notes on my phone that I've started that way. I've got a spreadsheet on my computer. I've got these things sitting around all over the place. And the great thing about writing them down – is it's a great way to inventory how many of your ideas are actually any good, because I bet I delete 75% of them before I ever do the first thing, right? But you want it there. But sometimes I like to say, let it marinate a little bit. You know, sometimes after you let it marinate,
let it simmer.
2, 3, 4 weeks later, it's not as good. Let it simmer. There you go.
Yeah, let it simmer. We just, when you're doing even meetings with regular meetings, there's always the parking lot, and that's where I put a lot of stuff. I used to write a lot more stuff down and put it in the parking lot so I could catalog how many of my ideas were crap. And what I would do is in the book, if I had an idea, I'd write down in the book, right? And then if I got enough feedback that I knew it was crap, I put a bold line through it. So that, and then if it was an idea that potentially I might want to come back and revisit, I would put a circle around it. Some of them didn't have lines and didn't have circles, but it was nice that when I went back into the book, you know, 3 months later, which is I would make a conscientious effort to recycle the book, you know, after a few months when everything is fresh to you now. It wasn't fresh when you wrote it, but it's fresh to you now because it's like, oh, I even thought of that? Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But just focus on the circles and get a sense of like, how many circles are there on this page? Well, there's 20 lines on this page, 20 ideas, and there's one circle. So, but then I found I would start beating myself. I was like, well, there's only one circle out of 20 ideas. So all my ideas suck. It's like, no, it's part of the process. What I've tended to do now is I just have one place. It's like, if I have an idea and it has a potential, it goes into that parking lot. And then that parking lot gets revisited and gets culled. And if I go back and I look at it 3 months later and I just try to find the ones that resonate, there's five left and there might be 20 ideas sitting in there, but there's only four or five. That parking, the ones that have resonated, that cascading-wise, there are only two or three of them that are on there. And that's things that I want to do still.
And when you start to catalog it like that, your best ideas start to rise to the top and
percolate.
The bad ones because what happens is that space gets crowded, right? Like my spreadsheet gets crowded and I've got too many things to process. So then I finally am just like, all right, I'm never going to get to this one. I'm never going to get to this one. This one's not that important. And then by that process of elimination, you start to see which ones actually do have some legs to it.
And when you're doing anything along really all these lines, but not just idea generation or idea fabrication over prolonged periods of time, what you're trying to do is you need to distill. You need to get it down to back to one thing.
Right.
One thing that you're going to be focusing on, you're going to put your energy into, because that's the only way that one thing ever has a chance to be successful. And when we're talking about marketing, we're talking about the marketing message makeover, and I think I mentioned this last time, we're trying to get it down to 11 words. 11 words which express one concept, one idea that is a unique identifier for you, separates you from everybody else. So when they hear that, they go, oh, that's you.
Yeah.
Right? And the second time they hear that, they go, oh, that's this person.
Yeah.
That's the message that will work. None of this pablum that everybody uses, all the words, we're about integrity and I get it.
Yeah.
You are. And you better operate that way. But everybody better operate that way if they're going to be any success in that business. It's not a unique differentiator.
Having integrity in financial services is kind of like having food in the restaurant industry. It's more of a prerequisite than a key differentiator.
It's exactly it. It's like if you go to a restaurant, they don't have food. I would be the first place, or the last place I would, last time I would go, ever go to that place.
I seriously went to Burger King one time. They were out of burgers. And I thought that was the funniest thing in the world. I went to the drive-thru and they said, "We're out of burgers." I said, "You're literally Burger King." Like, if the things that you can let happen if you own a Burger King, running out of burgers is would pretty not be much one of the number one. No. Well, John, this is great, man. I don't know if this is, I don't know how this show will end up landing with the general public, but it might end up being better for me building my own business, because I enjoy these conversations. It's very, very insightful, and I appreciate you joining me for this, and we'll follow our own advice, throw some things against the wall, and see where we're at in a couple of weeks and do it again.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, John.
Take care.
There we go, man.
Bye.